Censored nuclear scientists. The general public believes that radiation is only dangerous when it comes from an exploding nuclear bomb, and we have been well schooled in blowing off any warnings about the dangers of exposure to what's being called low-level radiation. But then you learned that there is a long history of scientists and researchers who found cause for concern about radiation being routinely censored. They have been shut out from funding and publication, and more and worse. All of this in service to the expansion of all things nuclear. And then, to top it off, a genuine expert tells you,
they were looking for strontium-90 in these children's bones, which indeed did collect it, but it didn't translate into an understanding of how it harmed anybody. And so what they were doing, and this shows what they were doing in general, with moving from tolerance dose to allowable limits, they were trying to find a dose of radiation that would not cause an immediate harm so that they could allow the nuclear industry to develop a pace and they could have plausible deniability for any of the diseases that might pop up that were due in whole or in part to radiation.
Well, when Cindy Fokers, radiation and health hazard specialist for Beyond Nuclear, points out a key motivation behind the nuclear industry's repression of scientific warnings about radiation exposure, you recognize that since well before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we've been manipulated into acceptance of that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Cindy Fokers, radiation and health hazard specialist for Beyond Nuclear, who, in partnership with UK governmental scientific advisor Ian Fairley, is author of the new book, The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. Where did the public's understanding of radiation that minimizes its risks come from? And who were those scientists who tried to raise warnings about radiation dangers only to become collateral damage to the growth of the nuclear industry? That's what we'll be learning about in today's featured interview. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than House Speaker Mike Johnson wants any members of Congress having in connection with the ongoing attempted passage of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, December 17, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., in New Jersey, a piece of medical equipment used for cancer scans has gone missing. The problem? It contains a small amount of radioactive germanium-68 that is used to calibrate a medical scanner's accuracy. If handled without proper gear, it can cause radiation poisoning and could cause permanent injury. The danger with losing track of radioactive material is that it can be used to build bombs, not mushroom cloud-sized nuclear explosions, but dirty bombs on the ground that can be deadly to the people who are in contact with it. An accident happened in Brazil at the city of Goiânia in 1987 after an unsecured radiotherapy source was stolen from an abandoned hospital site in the city by men who were just trying to make some money off scrap metal. It was handled by many people and resulted in 4 deaths. About 112,000 people were examined for radioactive contamination, and 249 of them were found to have been contaminated. Now, normally this would not be a lead story, But you have to factor in the drones. There has been what's being referred to as an epidemic of reported drone sightings across New York and New Jersey, and no one knows where they came from or what they're doing. According to John Ferguson, the CEO of Saxon Aerospace, a drone manufacturer in Kansas City, the only reason why they would be flying that low is because they're trying to smell something on the ground, such as gas leak or pockets of radiation, and added that he believed the drones were seeking something, quote, very important. Well, that's all it's taken for conspiracy theorists to link missing radioactive material with mystery drones, and assuming some sinister connection between the two. But that's not the only nuclear connection to these mysterious drones. A pair of them were seen spotted this week hovering over the Salem Nuclear Power Plant and the adjacent Hope Creek Generating Station, about 25 miles from Wilmington, Delaware, and 50 miles from Philadelphia. That has led New Jersey's largest utility, PSEG, to file a request with the Federal Aviation Administration asking to halt all air traffic over the two nuclear power plants. Keep in mind that there is absolutely no evidence that these drones are in any way connected to nuclear anything, and I personally believe it's probably just a bunch of college tech nerds pranking the country. If I'm wrong, I'll get you an update next week. Or not. In California, the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Station was supposed to close at the end of 2025, but a bill passed by the state legislature has kept it open for an additional 5 years, and plans are in place to extend it for another 15 after that. But critics say that Diablo Canyon is actually giving the state too much energy. In 2023, California generated enough hydropower to match the power we already got from the nuclear plant, and on top of that was the energy generated by solar. According to energy economist Richard McCann, the biggest culprit for generating excess power is Diablo Canyon, which was supposed to be retired. He explained, when the state has too much power, it can either try and sell it to neighboring states, often at rock-bottom prices, or it has to just dump the energy, which then goes to waste. Between solar and hydropower, California has plentiful clean energy, which was underestimated when it chose to extend the operating license of Diablo Canyon. Now comes a new report from World Business Academy that details negative health trends in the areas surrounding the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Between the time period of 1988 to 1990 and 2003 to 2010, the cancer incidence in San Luis Obispo County rose from 0.4% below the California average to 6.9% above it. The current cancer rate is the highest of all 20 counties in Southern California. And in the 10 zip code areas in Santa Barbara County, closest to Diablo Canyon, there was a greater rise in the rates of infant mortality, low birth weights, and total mortality than in the 5 zip code areas in the city of Santa Barbara, approximately 90 miles from the reactor. In Massachusetts, a Woods Hole report contradicts decommissioning company Holtec's claim that radioactive wastewater dumped from the closed Pilgrim reactor into Cape Cod Bay would quickly disperse. Here's Linda Pence-Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Holtec, the company that has purchased a number of permanently closed nuclear reactors in order to decommission them, last week encountered yet another obstacle to its dilution is the solution to pollution plans. One of the reactor sites Holtec has taken over is Pilgrim in Plymouth, Massachusetts, on the Cape Cod Bay, which closed permanently in 2019. Holtec's not-so-little problem there is what to do with what started out as at least 1.1 million gallons of radioactively contaminated wastewater stored at the site. The company first tried to release the wastewater into Cape Cod Bay, assuring residents and the immediately alarmed fishing community not to worry because A, the wastewater isn't dangerous anyway, B, everyone does this all the time at reactor sites and no one has gotten sick so far, and C, it would quickly disperse into the wider ocean. Holtec chose this disposal method for one reason alone: it is the cheapest. The proposal was vigorously fought by citizens, the state, and powerful Massachusetts Democrat Senator Ed Markey. The The state of Massachusetts effectively banned the discharge option, a decision Holtec is now contesting under appeal, something that could take months or longer to reach court. In the meantime, the prestigious Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has issued a report that contradicts Holtec's contention that the wastewater would quickly disperse out to sea. On the contrary, the report said, the wastewater would likely linger potentially for months and wash up on the shores of area communities. We found virtually no out-of-the-bay transport in winter and fall, and slightly larger but still low probability of some of the plume exiting the bay in spring and summer, said one of the report's authors. What's in the water is not fully disclosed, but certainly includes tritium along with other chemicals and radioactive isotopes. And while the Woods Hole study did not look at the health outcomes of releasing the radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay, only at the plume pathway, there are plenty of data that demonstrate the harmful effects of these radioisotopes on human health, especially women and children. After acquiring the Pilgrim reactor, Holtec's president and CEO, Chris Singh, assured surrounding communities that, quote, the decommissioning of Pilgrim will replicate the superb record of public health and safety and environmental protection that typified the plant's 47 years of operations. But since that acquisition, Markey observed, quote, Holtec has fallen woefully short on this commitment. He noted of the Woods Hole report that, quote, in light of these recent findings, I urge Holtec to develop a wastewater discharge plan that is informed and guided by scientific fact and community input. Absent a liquid discharge permit, Holtec's preferred solution since has been to quietly evaporate the wastewater into the air. It has done this by installing submerged electric heaters to increase the plant's ambient temperature, ostensibly in order to improve worker comfort and expedite the drying of plant components. But as Markey noted in an April 30, 2024 letter to Singh, the consequence of installing the heaters in that location, quote, is an increased rate of wastewater evaporation above the pace at which it occurs naturally. That 1.1 million gallons is now down to 880,000 gallons, according to Holtec's own reports. As Mary Lampert of local citizen group Pilgrim Watch, that has long been monitoring the reactor, points out, meteorological studies show 60% of winds blow offshore, which means at least some of that evaporated wastewater is going to fall into the bay anyway, and there's a good chance that's what Holtec will quietly continue to do. Holtec can evaporate all the water to meet its schedule to dismantle the reactor building, Lampert said. She and others met in October with staff from Massachusetts Governor Mary Healey's office to demand an immediate halt to the evaporation. So far, the governor has not taken action. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's Hot Story.
In Piketon, Ohio, a newly released Department of Energy report has exposed alarming radioactive contamination and environmental failures at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant. The findings, buried in an annual update to the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, reveal ongoing risks to public health and safety as radioactive waste cleanup efforts falter under questionable oversight. The DOE report unveils troubling evidence of radioactive isotopes infiltrating the environment, including technetium-99, a highly mobile and persistent isotope linked to nuclear waste, being detected in several groundwater monitoring wells through March, April, May, and June 2024. Enriched uranium was also found in water collection system samples at the site. The demolition of multiple structures on site, along with hazardous waste disposal operations, has created new airborne risks, including neptunium-237 in the air, a highly toxic radioactive material with a half-life exceeding 2 million years. The report also exposed systemic safety failures, including at least 3 fire incidents during 2024. This is a very complex report. We do have a summary that we will link to at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode number 704, and that will also include a link to the full report. An AI for Science forum held in London last month examined not only the technology's immense potential, but its dangers. While some hailed us as being at the brink of an incredible new era of discovery, maybe even a new kind of renaissance, others point out AI's potential pitfalls, including worsening inequality, financial crisis, catastrophic data breach, and collapsing ecosystems through extraordinary energy demands. Siddhartha Mukherjee, a cancer researcher at Columbia University in New York and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Emperor of All Maladies, stated that, quote, "I think it's almost inevitable that, at least in my lifetime, there will be some version of an AI Fukushima." We'll link to this article. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, help. I can't put it any plainer than that. Nuclear Hot Seat is funded entirely by donations from you, the listeners. And as we come to the end of 2024, it's clear that we are in need of your help with a donation of any size if we are to be able to continue. Think of what you get here. Nuclear Hot Seat is the only weekly program on nuclear issues with an archive of over 700 episodes available on our website and more than 300 citations as source material by academia.edu. That's quite a vote of confidence in our content. We do what we can to keep you up to date on all aspects of the nuclear world, from uranium mining through nuclear waste and weapons and everything in between. Our special reports from outside correspondents include the ICAN update on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, prepared by ICAN's Alistair Burnett at their headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland. The Nuclear Resistor, stories of those who have opposed nuclear and made it stick, with Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor newsletter. The Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, with journalist Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, and regular special reports on-site reporting, such as the recent Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit and the upcoming United Nations Third Meeting of States Parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. This work cannot be done without your support, and the time to help us with a donation is right now. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so you get a tax deduction before the end of the year, as well as a really good feeling for helping us out. So go to nuclearhotseat.com. Click on the red donate button to contribute what you can, be it a one-time donation of any amount or a recurring monthly coffee equivalent donation of as little as $5. NuclearHotSeat.com, red donate button, and if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please help, and whatever you can do, know that it is deeply appreciated. Now here's this week's featured interview. There are scientists who are our heroes, only we probably don't know it, or them, and that's intentional. These women and men have been attempting to raise the alarm about nuclear radiation dangers since long before the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. We just don't hear about them because they and their work were censored, repressed, unfunded, underfunded, buried, their reputations defamed, and their work condemned to obscurity. But that's the past, and hopefully that is about to change because of a new book, The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. It chronicles attempts by scientists to warn about radiation risks going back to the 1920s. It's about what these scientists learned, how they tried to get their information out, and how their voices were silenced. It's written by Ian Fairley, PhD, a UK-based scientist who has served as chief scientific advisor to the British government's Committee on the Radiation Risks of Internal Emitters, and Cindy Folkers, radiation and health hazard specialist for Beyond Nuclear. Together, they have created a book that is both a cornerstone resource for researchers and reporters and a heartbreaking set of tales of scientists who tried to share the radiation truths they discovered, only to have their work subverted by nuclear stakeholders. Note that this interview was originally supposed to be with both Ian and Cindy, but we had tech problems and were unable to get a clear connection with Ian from his home in London. We hope to catch up with his comments on a future show. There was no problem with connecting with Cindy Folkers, and we spoke on December 13, 2024. Cindy Folkers, it's great to have you here with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much.
First of all, congratulations to you and Ian Fairley on publication of your book, The Scientist Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. Who came up with the idea for this book, and what did you see as its need?
It's interesting because I had an older book from like the 80s that focused on nuclear whistleblowers, nuclear scientists, a number of people who pushed back against the nuclear industry and the fallout, I'll use that word, that came from them pushing back. And I shared that with Ian Fairley, and he had this idea. He's like, we need to do a book that maybe not just updates this one, but that expands it a little more in a different direction. And that was for the radiation scientists, some of whom we knew going in we would include in the book, but a number of them we didn't actually know we would include in the book, and some of which were surprises to us. And so it was interesting because Ian had originally thought it was his idea for the book. He had originally thought that we'd have about half a dozen or so people, and it ended up being closer to 40. So it's quite an amazing undertaking. I should say at the outset that this book is more of an academic tome. It is not a thriller page-turner kind of book, but it is extremely important. The history that it holds, the people that it lauds, the profiles that it presents, all weave together in and of themselves as individuals. They are important. But the stories that weave through their research and their experience is much more important in a way, because what it does is it points to how we have the radiation exposure regime that we have today, and how it exists in large part because it ignored and suppressed the research of the individuals profiled in this book. Many of them had their careers devastated. Many of them had their data stolen. There are a number of cases where their careers really, really did suffer. And that's part of the reason that we wrote this book. I also thought that it was an interesting book because it really pointed to a number of bits of history that came into stark focus as we were both researching this book. And so this is a roadmap to how we got to the radiation exposure regime that we have today. Notice I don't call it a radiation protection regime because I don't think it's protecting anything but the nuclear industry. And how we can pull ourselves out of deficit of the understanding of how radiation actually harms us.
How far back do these scientists go who have been disallowed from putting the true radiation information out? How long have we been tricked like this?
I will start with Hermann Müller, who is the first entry in the book. He's the first person that we profile. He had experiments, genetic experiments on fruit flies that showed that radiation damage would damage the first generation and that damage was heritable, meaning it carries across generations. He did his research in the late 1920s. I actually want to say that it might have started before that with the radium dial painters, because they were painting the dials on watch and clock faces. A lot of them had defense contracts, these companies, because it was dials for World War I era planes and watch faces that needed to be seen in the dark during battlefield conditions. And so actually, if you look back in the history, it kind of probably started with World War I and the Defense Department contracts that these companies had. It got worse, though, with the advent of nuclear weaponry. And they knew probably in the late 1940s, and if they didn't know, they suspected the genetic damage. So when the radium dial painters were exposed, their impacts were horrific. There were bones basically disintegrating within their bodies. They had jaws, some of their jaws. One of the women had her jaw fall off in her dentist's hands. I mean, these were horrific, horrific impacts. And the point is, they were able to be seen. They were not able to be hidden. And the company, of course, tried to say that it was syphilis or other types of venereal diseases, blaming the women, as usual. That's another thing that they tend to do when dealing with radiation exposures and women's concerns, particularly with concerns around children and children's exposures. And so this is how it started. This is how it started. And they would have been the late 19-teens, 1920s and 30s. The radium dial painters continued to suffer probably until mid-century, last century, 1950s-ish, right? And the issue there was the covering up or the not wanting to see what was staring them in the face got worse. And before I read this bit from Herbert Parker, I want people to understand he is an honorable mention. He's not in the main part of the book. And I can go into detail on that later, but it's not necessary. The reason that he's in this book is because of what I'm about to read right now. While director of health physics at Oak Ridge, Parker had recognized the implications of the research on fruit flies by Muller. That is, no threshold existed for radiation's genetic effects, and radiation's impact on the individual and future generations were cumulative. Parker concluded, quote, there would be no true tolerance dose, but rather an acceptable injury limit, end quote. He was among the first scientists to warn that exposing large numbers of people to low radiation doses for long periods of time would be a matter of concern due to the appearance of recessive genes in the population. Parker failed to anticipate, in the late 1940s, the widespread use of nuclear technology exposing large numbers of people to radioactive emissions. That's the end of this particular passage. And so what we have here to unpack this are a couple of things. And I want to focus first the impact of small exposures to large numbers of people, because that is a thread that weaves its way through the research in this book. And I think it's important to pull on that thread. Dr. John Goffman, who has a profile in the book, talks about the danger that nuclear power poses because it exposes large numbers of people to small doses of radiation over large periods of time. Alice Stewart, also in the book, had this concern. And then toward the end, David Brenner had this concern with regard to X-ray machines in airports because they would expose large numbers of all ages of people to little doses of radiation as they went through airport security. And because of that concern, those, most if not all of those X-ray machines that were in the airports have now been removed. But they've long known that when you're looking at genetic impacts, low doses over long periods of time exposing cross-generational or transgenerational exposures would potentially be a problem. But it points back to what they called a tolerance dose. And as Herb Parker says, if it's going to impact your genetics and there's not a dose below which there is no impact, then there is no tolerance dose. And this is important because this is the point at which the language, which had previously, and this was 1948 when Herb Parker said this, this is the point, the tolerance dose, at which the language changed from a tolerance dose that was focused on human health, how much could we tolerate, transferred to an acceptable limit of exposure, or a permissible limit, or an as low as reasonably achievable limit, all of which have been used during the history of radiation exposure standards. That's an industry-focused term. Those are industry-focused terminologies. And so when you have an acceptable exposure or an as low as reasonably achievable, it is the industry that benefits from that because it's whatever they can achieve and whatever they have to prove that they can achieve. And what that ends up doing is it doesn't center human health any longer. It centers what industry needs to proliferate.
Major concerns have been expressed about the increased impact of radiation on women, children, and of course the unborn, the fetus, and the whole reproductive system. What did these scientists have to say about that?
Alice Stewart had a lot to say about that work. She examined women who were X-rayed when they were pregnant and found that there were increases of childhood leukemia among women who were pregnant while receiving an X-ray, as opposed to women who were not X-rayed during pregnancy.
This was a standard thing to check up on the child to make certain that the fetus was developing the right way?
That is correct. And her study to determine that was in the 1950s. It took in the United States until the 1970s for them to recommend to not X-ray pregnant women unless absolutely necessary. So mind the gap there. That was 20 years at least that it took for the Food and Drug Administration in this country to protect pregnant women and their pregnancies from radiation exposure from the time that Alice Stewart raised the flag until we in this country decided to protect pregnant women. And actually, the book highlights this. One of the people who pushed back on Alice Stewart's work was Richard Doll, D-O-L-L. Sir Richard Doll. So he was knighted by the Queen. He was a British physician who became an epidemiologist. He was at Oxford at the same time that Alice Stewart was at Oxford. And what happened was Alice Stewart decided that she wanted to establish the Oxford Survey on Childhood Cancers. She interviewed thousands of mothers of leukemic children to figure out why the women who had children who had leukemia, their child might have gotten leukemia. And what ended up happening was she determined that there was a surprise link between pregnant mothers' x-rays and their child's leukemia incidence. The x-rays were considered harmless at the time, and her first study was groundbreaking, but the medical profession at the time turned against her study and against her personally. And Richard Doll was one of the ones that led the charge against her research and against her study. He was a contemporary of her. He criticized her study in ways that actually ended up not being true. He forced her out of Oxford. She had to go to a different university. She had to take all of her data to a different university. And they were subsequently locked out of the UK's government consultation process on medical research. Several years later, Doll established a new study of childhood cancer with abundant funding, partly from the nuclear industry, and he denied Stewart's work. Worse still, it was because of Doll's misinformation that more than 20 years would pass before official medical guidance would catch up with Stewart's research findings and protect women from x-rays. So he is pretty much the one that made it so that it took 20 years for medical practice to change in order to protect pregnancy. If you look at the careers of Richard Doll and Alice Stewart, they stand in stark contrast. And one of the reasons this is important is because this happened to a lot of people in this book. Doll's career discovered that smoking was connected to lung cancer. That resulted in his knighthood and many accolades. Stewart's discovery of x-rays on pregnant women, that they doubled the risk of subsequent childhood cancer, resulted in ridicule and being denied funding, being refused a professorship for decades, and being denied positions on government medical panels. Richard Doll was largely responsible for this professional ostracizing. However, Stewart persisted nevertheless, and she continued to publicize on the risks of low-level radiation exposure. She did so for U.S. nuclear workers, and she continued down this trajectory with really stellar research. Later, Doll retracted most of what he had said about Stewart as he realized that her childhood cancer findings were correct, in fact. He admitted, quote, "It looks like Alice will be proved right." After Doll died in 2005, he was discovered to have received industry funding for research which had absolved several toxic substances, Agent Orange, vinyl chloride, as examples, from disease causation. And Doll, in his articles, also largely exonerated industrial pollution from causing cancers. In general, his work, now looking back, was really in conflict of interest. A lot of his conclusions were not only incorrect, but they were a result of industry funding, one could argue. Meanwhile, Alice Stewart and her findings on radiation and human health have been found to be largely correct.
These are, of course, infuriating and heartbreaking stories throughout the book. It points to the question, why are children and women more sensitive to radiation?
That is the million-dollar question, quite literally. We have some theories. The theories are as follows. None of these have been proven, in fact, correct yet. The first theory is that women contain, or females contain, more estrogen, different levels of estrogen depending on the life cycle that the female is in. And the estrogen pathway seems to be worked on by radioactivity in some way. Now, this is a medical hypothesis. It has not been explored further, but it is one thing that might be an issue. And in fact, for the estrogen piece, there was a 1960 Federal Radiation Committee report that basically stated that hormones might be one of the things that radiation would impact. So this kind of tracks with earlier reports. It could be estrogen, maybe, sure. It could also be stem cells. Certain people, younger people, children, babies, et cetera, have more stem cells in their bodies. That could be an explanation. It could be that women have more fat in their bodies. This is an issue because certain, like radioactive xenon, is released by nuclear reactors as a matter of operational course. It's called a noble gas. It is a fat lover. And let's face it, most women just have more fat than men do. And so when a model is made for radiation's impact, we have a reference man. Well, his fat content is a lot less than an adult woman's fat content. And so it could be fat. It could be that women have more reproductive organs and that they are more sensitive. For children, it could be that they are developing faster. They have a lot more cell growth. They're developing bodies, and they need to have a lot of resources, and their cells are dividing quicker, and faster cell division could just by law of probabilities make it possible that cells could be more sensitive to radiation exposure through the process of division, which is sensitive to radiation exposure and damage. And pregnancy the same way, especially pregnancy, because you are building a human body during a pregnancy. We know that radionuclides like tritium, carbon-14 are basic building blocks of the human body. These happen to be radioactive, but carbon is a basic building block of the human body when it's non-radioactive. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen, and both carbon and hydrogen work to build human bodies. And that's why when pregnant, the pregnancy, the developing fetus collects up to twice the amount of carbon and hydrogen while it's developing. Now, of course, that's not a problem if these are not radioactive, but nuclear reactors release these two radionuclides, both of which collect in the fetal tissue two times the concentration that they do in maternal tissue, up to two times. And so there could be a number of reasons. Can I point to a single one? No. Will I say the thing that everyone always says? Probably. And that is that it's probably a combination of all of these, depending on the individual you look at. One may be more weighted than the other. And do we need more research? Yes, we absolutely need more research. And we absolutely need to shed the problems that this book points to, which are problems of determining what science was actually saying versus what was covered up.
This is, of course, infuriating because so much pain and suffering could have been avoided if only we knew the truth when the truth was available, except for the fact that it was being repressed. Now, what non-cancer impacts are associated with radiation and perhaps were pointed out by the scientists in your book?
There are a number, but I want to focus on the cardiovascular impacts. That's cardiovascular system, so it's heart. And there was a recent study that came out of uranium looking at its impacts on heart specifically, but the heart is only a part of the cardiovascular system. Stroke is a disease of that system, and there are other diseases that fit in there as well. It's important to remember that non-cancer diseases were not necessarily thought of or known. Cancer was what they were mostly focusing on, and it is what the people in this book mostly focused on. But there were, in the research of some of these folks, indications and hints that cardiovascular was an issue. I would say that the work that really pointed to cardiovascular being an issue, in my mind, was the work of Dr. Yuri Bondashevsky, when he looked at people and children and the impact of having radioactive cesium in their systems. A radioactive cesium is known to attack muscle, so of course it's going to be attacking the heart muscle. That was where you had cardiovascular impacts that probably, that was the first time that they might have been mostly seen in a more sort of public, let's say, way, or even in a more forward way for research. But really, if you look at the Hiroshima Nagasaki studies, there are data in there that also point to cardiovascular impacts. They were exposed at a certain time, of course, but to uncover that information in the data can take decades. And this brings me to another issue when it comes to protecting against radiation exposure, and one of the things that is important to understand for this book. This is not you get exposed and you drop dead kind of scenario. This is a long-term, slow burn, slow violence kind of issue where you will have multi-generational exposures, and again, pointing back to the genetic impacts, that could manifest themselves in diseases many decades later, generations later. And so the warnings in this book are not just warnings about exploding atomic bombs. No, I mean, that's horrible. That's absolutely horrific. But the impact of radiation exposure doesn't go away with the end of the flash of the bomb. Even the bomb deposits radionuclides all over, worldwide, everywhere they've looked since the atomic bomb tests, the atmospheric tests, the ones above ground, they have found plutonium. Does that mean that plutonium is everywhere? No, but it is everywhere that they've looked. It is a slow exposure and an additive or multiplicative exposure. So you have, starting with the bombs, and the bomb radiation from the tests went everywhere. We now have maps that show this. And then you add to that the reactor meltdowns that have happened and released, Chernobyl, Fukushima, Three Mile Island, others, right, that release without meltdowns. Those three had meltdowns or partial meltdowns. But there are other releases that happen because of accidents that don't result from meltdowns. Every reactor releases, as a matter of course, radiation. And so what you end up having is a slow buildup in the environment of these kinds of radionuclides. But also, even after the radionuclides have decayed, you have a slow buildup of damage in, as Herb Parker pointed out, in populations and in the genetics of the populations. And so it's extremely important to understand that this is not something that happens that you will be able to see with your eyes necessarily. This is something that happens over time, and what it will manifest itself in disease increases of all kinds, because once you've messed with the genetics, you're messing with the viability of humans. It will show itself in the inability to get and keep a pregnancy. So that's a fertility issue. Those are just two examples. And so it shows itself in subtle ways, and it shows itself in ways that can be attributable to other things. And I'm not claiming that every disease incidence that's happening now is due to radiation exposure, no. But what I am saying is there are some percentages that may not have happened without the ongoing low-grade exposures that are happening to individuals.
This is all shown through multiple stories that are told in the course of this book. The question about today is, are nuclear proponents still repressing? I think the word used in some of your materials is throttling, but repressing independent science pointing to the dangers of radiation.
Yes. And there have been instances, not included in the book directly, but there have been instances where one of these scientists was told by a scientist. These instances may be in the book, but some of them may not, but I'm going to share them with you anyway, and I'm going to keep anonymized. I'm going to do the anonymized thing. So there was one person in this book who had someone who is very high up and respected in the National Cancer Institute tell this person to go back to where this person lived and get the right answer with respect to the findings that lower doses of radiation increased diseases among this particular population that this person was studying, implying that the right answer was going to be that there wasn't any harm, when what this researcher was finding was actually, yes, there were disease instances from what were supposed to be lower exposures. So that's the first thing. There are instances in this book. We saw it with Alice Stewart, where her work was, to use the word, throttled in the day. She had instances of, you know, having difficulty getting funding for research, having her funding published. But there have been people more recently that have shared stories with us of their research going to various publications, and people who were meant to be reviewers for those publications just putting it in a desk drawer and forgetting that it exists, and then the publication can't publish it. So there are very sort of subtle ways that this information it's different in a way. I mean, you had Rosalie Bertel. They attempted to run her off the road at least once, possibly twice. I don't remember how many instances in the book. You can look at her profile that we've outlined, and she talked about that. The ways, though, that they do it now are more subtle than that. But as far as the research outcomes are concerned, and as far as the radiation exposure regulation outcomes are concerned, the outcome for those things is the same, right? It's really hard to get research that pushes back against the nuclear technology line that, you know, small doses, they like to call them small doses. I call them exposures that are considered small. They push back against that, that they actually do result in harm. It's really hard to get research accepted that states that, even so. So this has continued. It has continued in ways that are not as blatant.
There are people who would consider you and Ian alarmist, or who claim that people living near nuclear power facilities do not get cancer from their proximity to those reactors. My definition of an alarmist is Paul Revere. He definitely set the alarm. What do you say? What is your response to people who would consider you and Ian alarmists?
Well, if that's the definition of an alarmist, then all of these people in this book are alarmists, right? I mean, they're all sounding the alarm, and they've been sounding the alarm since, you know, the late 20s, starting with Herman Muller, as we discussed before, right through the 1940s with K.Z. Morgan, who is also at Oak Ridge, sounding the alarm on lower doses and how there might not be a safe dose, with Herbert Parker saying the same thing. And, you know, right up to 1960, where the first report of the Federal Radiation Committee, which was later subsumed into Environmental Protection Agency, this report mentions standard children. It's interesting because that means that they knew or they suspected something was wrong. But indeed, what happened was with standard children is that they decided that later reports were not going to reflect that anymore, and that standard man began to take center stage.
And standard man, radiation man, as he's sometimes referred to, is the standard by which, quote unquote, safety in radiation exposure is set, despite the fact that, and this is according to the work of Mary Olson of Gender and Radiation Impact Project, women are twice as vulnerable to radiation as men, and little boys are five times as much, and little girls are 10 times as vulnerable to radiation as the dose, but the dose safety is set according to the male adult body.
For little girls, it's probably somewhere between 7 and 10. But, you know, when you start to have a representative model like a radiation man, right, or a reference man, same thing for this purpose, that underestimates something by 7 times, and you start to expose members of the public, not just workers, then it becomes a problem, of course, a huge problem. And that is absolutely correct. And this is also shown in the human radiation experiments when they were trying to harvest the dead body parts of children to check for strontium-90 deposition. This happened in the 50s. And why this was so outrageous, I mean, in addition to the just the ultimate ethical problem that it clearly poses and the ick factor that goes along with that, they were looking for strontium-90 in these children's bones, which indeed did collect it, but it didn't translate into an understanding of how it harmed anybody. And so what they were doing, and this shows what they were doing in general, with moving from tolerance dose to allowable limits, they were trying to find a dose of radiation that would not cause an immediate harm so that they could allow the nuclear industry to develop a pace and they could have plausible deniability for any of the diseases that might pop up that were due in whole or in part to radiation. And that is one thing, too, that I was reading in the book as I was reading through the book, the bit about the language and how they move the language from focus on public health to focus on what the industry needed. I always recommend that people read their own work more than once because it came to me in stark relief after I read the book again that this is what was going on with the language. But this whole idea of trying to absolve radiation from any of the diseases that it may be causing in the population because of the genetic impact is very, very clear. And they knew since at least the 1920s, they knew that there was a possibility that there were going to be genetic implications. And so everything that they did, you could argue, that followed from that, all of the human radiation experimentation, all of the ways that they couched the language, they were trying to find a dose that they could claim, the dose that would hide the actual impact, that would be low enough to hide the immediate impact of radioactivity on the human system, right, and on our genetics and in our population, so that by the time any diseases showed up, they would be able to plausibly deny that radiation had caused them. And, you know, I think that that's a reasonable argument to make given what this book lays out. And I should point, too, that this book isn't just the profiles of people. There are scientific appendices in the back. There are annexes in the back, scientific and historical, that lay this all out. And again, this is more meant to be a reference. If people want to take this book and draw conclusions and do further research, have at it, because this is why this book exists. And this is why it's needed. It is a historical record. It is a record of tribute. And people need to read it because it is extremely important to understand how we got here with radiation exposure and how it is that people seem to memory hole all of the dangers that are happening with nuclear power, so that we're now actually, some of us are actually considering it for climate crisis mitigation, which is absolutely not the way to go. Dangerous technology.
The book is entitled The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. How can people access a copy of it?
It was printed by Ethics Press. They're a UK publisher. Type in our author names or the title of the book, it'll pop up. The Ethics Press choices, they'll have ebook, hardcover, and paperback. I recommend the ebook. It's cheaper, you get it immediately, and you have it then forever. And that's how people can order it.
Your book is an important addition to our literature and our understanding of what we've been up against. I've done a lot of work on media manipulation around nuclear issues and actually have an entire play about that. I'll talk about that on a future program. But this is important, not just as an academic piece, but for anybody who's interested in nuclear and wants to figure out exactly how we've been hornswoggled into accepting this technology and not understanding its dangers. This is a crucial book. The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation by Cindy Folkers and Ian Fairley. And I'm sorry that technical difficulties prevented Ian from being on this call, but Cindy Folkers, I want to thank you so much, not only for having written the book, but for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so very much.
That was Cindy Folkers, radiation and health hazard specialist for Beyond Nuclear, who, along with scientist and nuclear consultant Ian Fairley, wrote the just-released book, The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. If you wish to purchase a copy of the book, don't go to Amazon. All they have listed is the hardcover, and the price is eye-watering. But you can get either the paperback or the ebook copy directly from the publisher, Ethics Press. You can also access the information by going to beyondnuclear.org and searching for a link to the book. We will, of course, have these links up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 704.
Activists, shout out.
Congratulations to M.V. Ramana, a physicist, professor, and Simmons Chair in Disarmament, Global, and Human Security at the University of British Columbia. His book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change, has just been named among Climate and Capital Media's picks for, quote, the best climate books to give, read, and share over the holidays. We here at Nuclear Hot Seat concur, as it is clear, concise, eminently readable, and a great gift for those who think that somehow nukes are going to save us from the climate crisis. We interviewed Ramana about his book and his findings, and he is featured in both Nuclear Hot Seat number 693 from October 1st, with the conclusion of our interview in Nuclear Hot Seat number 695 on October 15. We'll have links up to where you can purchase his book on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com under this episode, number 704. We note with sadness the passing of Shigeko Sasamori, one of Youth Arts New York Hibakusha Story's great heroes. She passed away in her sleep this week at the age of 92. At 13, she was in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and was badly injured by the atomic bomb blast. She has worked tirelessly through the years to tell her story in a plea for the total elimination of nuclear weapons. She tells her story on a video that was shot for Youth Arts New York Hibakusha Stories, and we will have a link to it up on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 704. Shigeko Sasamori was 92 years old. And a reminder that is a request. Next year is the 80th anniversary of the start of all of this atomic madness, starting with the Trinity blast on July 16. If and as you as an individual or as part of a group are doing anything to commemorate this horrific anniversary, when you post it online, please use the marker #Nuclear80, and that's 80. In that way, we have a technique for unifying our efforts, pulling us together, and hopefully having a website that's going to be mentioning all of the events happening around the world. It doesn't have to be a big event. It doesn't have to be a small one. It can be a major demonstration or a single person standing on a street corner holding a sign that says no nukes. Whatever we do, let's unify it under #Nuclear80, so that as we get closer to the anniversaries of Trinity, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki, anyone who wants to find out what is happening around the world need only put in one hashtag, and all of our stories will come up. It's a way of amplifying our voices around the issues. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 17, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Go to NuclearHotSeat.com. You cannot miss the yellow opt-in box that's going to pop up. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week we will be able to send you one, count it one, email, which has a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a brief description of some of the content. It guarantees that you never need miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. And of course, you're always free to sign up for it on any of the podcast platforms, because we are everywhere, just like radiation. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to us at info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please not Facebook Messenger, that's just a mess. Make it the email. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help, especially between now and the end of the year. Anything helps, and we always appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, in the event of nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. That's a quote from former Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev. There you have it. You have just received your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all truly in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.